So, Dad, it is December 16th at 12:16. Is that right? No, can't be 12. No, it's 10:45. And we are sitting in my art studio 3 days, 2 days from, so I had a double mastectomy on Thursday, the 13th. Mm-hmm. And so now it's the 16th, so 3 days ago. And we're hanging out. Everybody is at church next door, and we're being the rebels.
Not everybody's at church next door. You have a daughter upstairs sleeping.
Yes, Fiona's upstairs sleeping, who is still up at 3:30 last night talking in full kilter. So is it strange for you to have been helping Candy with her breast situation a month ago, and now you're doing the same thing for your daughter?
The removal of implants for her. Right.
Right. Removal of implants that she had for 40 years, but dealing with breast strains. And now I have new implants and dealing with breast strains. Kind of an ironic, kind of a strange serendipitous situation.
It is.
I have to say I really enjoyed waving to you this morning in bed. My bed was looking at you in your bed. And it was fun to look and see you and wave.
I just wanted to make sure the dogs were not jumping up on your bed.
Of course, the cat the whole time, and that all night the cat was meowing in the basement.
and Milo had food and water. I don't know what her what his problem was.
Yeah.
That's his problem.
So as difficult as this is for me to go through it, through the whole breast cancer thing, I'm sure it's probably more difficult for you to go through it as well in a different way.
No, it's not more difficult for me. It's more difficult for you because you're the one that's having to deal with it. Of course, I likewise am dealing with it, but we have time to be together, which probably would not have ever happened otherwise. It's, the last part of the month. Your son Angus is coming in this coming Thursday from Missouri. Shay is coming in from Scotland, we think, on Friday. And with some of her stuff, we don't know how the rest of her stuff is getting here. Fiona's here. Nate is just doing great in terms of how he's providing. But this is a very special time for us to be together and to share, you know, which we've probably never had this much time before, and I don't know when we will again. So I have thought that as difficult a time as this is, it does present a kind of opportunity for us to share.
Well, I told you I usually get my way, and so maybe this elaborate concoction was to get you up here for Christmas.
No.
No, I'm joking. Of course. But yeah, it's fun to be able to look at some of Grandma and Grandpa's ornaments and talk about them also, and you know, watch me hanging out while I make my new Ms. Mastectomy paper doll collection.
Yeah, I appreciate the fact that you were able to take the several almost dozen CDs that I had created about maybe 15 years ago when I took tape recordings, cassette tape recordings, audio recordings from interviews that I did with my parents when they were living in Fruitland about 3 or 4 years before Mother died in 1998 and Dad died the following year in 1999. And I recall that it was a weekend that I had gone down to Fruitland from Louisville, where I was living at the time. And there were things going on in my Sunday school class, the Solidarity class at Crescent Hill Baptist Church, where we were dealing with spiritual autobiographies, in which case we in the class, and there were about a dozen and a half, maybe, you know, people that showed up regularly. We would take turns. We would pick a date, and on that particular Sunday, we would sit in our little circle group in Sunday school, and there was sort of a general format that we followed in terms of talking about ourselves and our own spiritual history. And once we shared that information, people could ask questions, and we had a sheet of questions that we could follow in terms of preparing ourselves for what we wanted to share. And I thought, you know, this would be a good idea to get this information from Mother and Dad. And so I went down to their house for a long weekend. I forget what particular date it was. And took these blank tapes and sat in the living room of their house. And I think I started with Dad, I believe. He had come in from the garden. Mother was in the kitchen doing preparation for a meal. And so I began the tape interviewing Dad as if, you know, he was sort of a stranger, and ask him questions like, tell me about what you remember about your great-grandparents, if you know anything, your grandparents on both sides of your family. Tell me about your father and mother, and tell me about yourself as a child, the house you grew up in. Tell me what your room was like. Tell me what kind of pictures or was hanging in your house. Tell me what books there were. Tell me what music there was. Tell me who showed up for Sunday dinner, if anybody. He was part of a large family. I think he had 6, 7, or 8 brothers and sisters and that sort of thing. And it was interesting. I learned a great deal about my dad that I never knew before. Mm-hmm. And then I did the same thing with my mother, and I learned a great deal about my mother, her childhood, that I just didn't know before. In just a few years, 3 or 4 years later, I used some of those excerpts from those recordings as part of their memorial service. When my mother died in the summer of 1998, and my dad the following summer of 1999. And having their story and their voices as part of explaining their own childhood, as well as some of their experiences getting ready for missionary appointment to Nigeria, and after they got to Nigeria, it was a real treasure, and I'm glad I did that. And in Florida, some years later, as I said, maybe 15 years or so ago, I took these cassette tapes and had them converted to CDs. And then you have downloaded them, uploaded them, whatever you call, and now they are available to both you and me on our phones for us to listen to. The originals, the tapes, and a copy of the original CDs are, of course, at Duke University's archive for the McGee Family Collection as part of the Baptist Mission to Nigeria collection. And these are stories about our families. And I guess this is a little bit about you and me and each other. Mm-hmm. So, you know, you're 46 years old. You and Nate have a magnificent, beautiful family of Angus, of Shay, of Fiona. You've lived very interesting lives, done so much in your lives already. And it's, you're a real gift to me. I'm real proud of you.
Well, thank you. Thank you for being here and helping to wash my sweaty sheets and cut up some oranges and drain the blood and milk the blood drains and all that crap.
Yeah, I mean, it's nursing care, which I'm not a nurse, but I can help. And having gone through this with Candy fairly recently, I was a little bit familiar with how to do some of those things.
Yeah.
So, you know, as you go forward, this is a very tough time in your life, and we are hopeful that next week when we get the results from the biopsies that they did and from your surgery this past Thursday, that's good news. I know it's scary for you. We don't, as many people have said, and I've heard my parents say, we don't know what the future holds. We know who holds the future. And as I said, I'm approaching, in my own life, I'm 75. And my father lived until he was about 86. And I may live that long, I may not. But the fact is, we all have to deal with how things will be eventually with each of us. And this sort of helps us focus a little bit on that. My mother's death was very sudden. She had just finished taking a shower in preparation for Deborah, to whom I was married at the time, and my arrival from Louisville. I'd been working on the house for a couple of weeks, putting mastic over the roof and doing all kinds of maintenance stuff. She had flown up to Louisville, and we were driving down to my folks' place in Hendersonville. And on the top of the mountain, driving between Knoxville and Fruitland, at the top of the mountain where phone reception was good, and we had, you know, phones that we could plug into the car and not the kind of cell phones that we have here, but we could call. And I talked to Mother, and she was ready and looking forward to our arriving, but she sounded tired. And when we got to the house, she had just a few minutes earlier had her cerebral hemorrhage, and nobody was at the door when we drove into the yard. Which is strange, because every time we drove into the front gate of their front yard, somebody would be coming out the door. Mm-hmm. And there was nobody coming out the door, which I thought was very strange. And when Deborah and I got out of the car and Dad showed up at the door with a phone in his hand, very distressed, he had come in from outside and found Mother on the floor of the bathroom. Mm-hmm. And we didn't know what had happened. That was the end of her life, which was very sudden. EMS, I called him EMS, I believe. Local community volunteers showed up in an ambulance. They took her to the hospital in Hendersonville. And Mike Smith came over, Dad, Mike Smith, Deborah and I went over to the hospital. I'm trying to remember the name of the hospital in Hendersonville, but anyway. And she was there, and she never recovered consciousness, and we were there not knowing what the problem was. I do believe she was able to hear, but she was breathing very raspily, like, you know, it was noisy. She just seemed like, well, she wasn't aware of things, but I remember we were singing to her. I sang a little tune that I had heard from them and remember their singing to me and my being able to sing as a 4-5-year-old kid in Nigeria. And tears came to her eyes. So I think she understood or heard. They flew her by helicopter to Mission Hospital in Asheville. And after we arrived in Asheville, the physician who took care of her, whose own mother had died just recently, told us what he thought the situation was, what they knew the situation was, and what the possible prognosis would be. And we felt that at her age, at 81, knowing how much she hated being possibly invalid, how much she would have been a terrible patient, not able to do things, we made the decision to go ahead and just let things take its place. And so I stayed with her primarily, for the most part, for the next 2 or 3 days. Sydney was there for a little while. I don't think my dad stayed with her by himself, but he visited. And then a couple of days later, on a Friday morning, I think it was the 17th of July, she died.
And her birthday is January 13th.
It is.
Coming up pretty soon.
It is.
And we still have her plates and cups that I use. And well, I think that the apple doesn't fall from far from the tree. I think I'm a pretty bad invalid, too. I don't like to.
Well, I think we all would be. we all would be. that after she died, it was just a couple weeks later, and I was in Florida. I had work. I had no way not to be working. You and Nate had just graduated the previous May from the seminary in Richmond, right, and had been ordained, and mother and dad had been there for his graduation and his ordination. And that was the last trip they made together as a couple. Well, when mother died, you and Nate and Angus and very young Shay moved in with my dad for, it seemed to me like a couple of months.
Yeah, like 3 months. Yeah, something like that.
To help him, you know, and it was nice that you had been in that home just a couple of years earlier, the summer following your sophomore year at Mount Holyoke. Your mom, Sherry, had arranged for you to have some sort of meaningless, repetitive job at the local GE plant that produced light bulbs. And so you learned a good lesson by learning what tedious, repetitive kind of work can be. Monotonous. And I recall, you know, I think you may have had some mixed feelings about going down there and living that summer with my parents. However, it turned out really well. I remember driving you down there and dropping you off with my folks and then going back to Louisville. And it seems to me like 3 or 4 days later, or it was less than a week, we talked over the phone and you were having a lot of struggle and issues with getting adjusted to them, to their lifestyle, to whatever. And I just encourage you to stick it out and to sort of manage it the best you could. And you did. You had actually a very wonderful summer. Mm-hmm. That was when Dad was finishing up or doing the work at the Spanish Mission, mm-hmm, which he had been in charge of helping to build. You did a wonderful pen and ink sketch of the building, which hangs on the office wall of my house in Southwest Ranches, Florida. And you were active with the kids, the little Spanish mission there, and at the time that all this was happening. You were active with the group of kids there at the church in Fruitland, mm-hmm, right across the street from where they lived, and made good friends there. And during the course of that summer, you became quite bonded to mother and dad, and mm-hmm, they to you.
Yeah.
I recall when your mom and I were divorced, my parents were really upset, and that was my second divorce, and you were about, this was in 1988, so you had finished your sophomore year of high school, I think, at Brown School in Louisville, and I remember my dad just being really pissed and accusing me of throwing you on the trash heap of life, assuming that I would be neglecting you,
right,
and not being a good parent. As it turned out, your being with your mother those 2 years, last 2 years of high school, gave you time to be supported with your classmates at the Brown School, where you graduated as a senior in 1990 as the valedictorian in your class. It gave you and your mom time to be together. It gave you a lot of freedom, mm-hmm, in terms of the experiences you had with your group of friends in high school, where you guys went places and did things that I probably
would
never have sanctioned. I remember when we were driving down to visit them, and that was a 5 hour trip to Knoxville and another 2 hours to Fruitland. It was a long trip when we went one way, and I remember we were driving down the Appalachian Mountains on the way to Knoxville, and we were talking about this, that, and the other, and I apologized to you for maybe not being there for you, it seemed. And you said, oh, that's okay. You know, it's been an opportunity for me to do what I wanted to do, and so forth. And I remember sharing that experience with Dr. Bob Baxter, Robert Baxter, who is a psychiatrist and the director of the Bingham Child Guidance Clinic, where I was working at the time. He was a wonderful man, a very smart psychiatrist, teacher, and administrator, which is an unusual combination for a physician. And I remember sharing that your comments with him, and he said, you know, it's amazing how different ways hostility can be expressed.
That's funny.
And I had good experiences with you. I remember your and my going over. Well, you went to Italy.
Yeah.
The summer after your junior year in high school. Mm-hmm. You were taking art lessons. You didn't have all the art lessons you needed at Brown School, so you actually would drive yourself over to, was it Westport or Ballard?
Ballard
School for an additional higher level art course than you could get there at Brown School. Mm-hmm. You went with the University of Louisville students to Italy for 6 weeks. Mm-hmm. That summer of after your junior year, and had a wonderful experience over there. Came back with a half dozen large sketch paintings that you had done, and in the St. James Art Fair in the first weekend of October of 1993, it would have been, after coming back from Italy, you were chosen as the first place winner in the student art competition, which Scholastic competition,
yeah.
And got a $1,000 scholarship for your college expenses the following year, and so you were doing a lot of things in school as you graduated. Now we were trying to figure out where you would go to college. You had some choices. I think you visited one of the schools in sort of west central Kentucky. I can't remember.
Murray? No, was it Murray?
It may have been Murray. I think.
Well, I was there for like a 2-week art program in the summer.
Yeah, and you actually got accepted at the University of Kentucky in the architectural program. You were accepted there. Mm-hmm. You actually got accepted at Cincinnati School of Art. Mm-hmm. And in terms of trying to decide what you wanted to do, you basically wanted to get away from home. and you were attracted to the Northeast because, it seemed appealing to you. Uh-huh. And so we were trying to decide where to apply. So you and I went to the library. There in Louisville to look up, and at that time, you know, there was no internet search that we could do. We had to look up stuff, you know, in paper-bound books, and we looked at some of the ratings of possible schools you could go to in that area. And we settled on looking in the Massachusetts area, and we looked at the various possibilities, and you had heard. You had heard from one of your teachers at school, I don't know which teacher it was, who was recommending that you check out one of the schools, Smith College, Holyoke, Mount Holyoke, UMass, mm-hmm.
Hampshire,
and there's one other one.
Amherst.
And that those five schools in a very close geographic proximity to each other. Where you could go to take classes at any, the libraries were interconnected. And so we said, well, what about those schools? Let's look at those five schools. So we went to the library. Amherst was co-ed, mm-hmm. and very popular and very expensive. Mm-hmm. Hampshire was so new, they just sort of let you build your own curriculum, and we didn't
out there.
It was just way unknown as to how that would work out. UMass was sort of big, and you had information from your school at Brown that students that went from the Brown School, which is a small group of students, did not do particularly well in a large
college environment, and UMass, I think, had 20,000 students on campus. And so we figured that would be very difficult for you. Mm-hmm. So the choice came down between Smith and Mount Holyoke. And both were very good schools. Smith, in the literature that we were reading, suggested that it had a sort of strong lesbian culture on campus, and Mount Holyoke seemed less so. So we applied at Mount Holyoke, and you and your mom went up there for a visit. Mm-hmm. After, I think, they had accepted you. I had to take you down to Lexington for an interview with a Mount Holyoke alumnus.
Yeah, remember we made that visit with Mitch McConnell's daughter, Ellie. Because Ellie was going to Smith, so Ellie and I and mom and Ellie's mom went up to, she visited Smith and I visited Mount Holyoke, but it's kind of funny to think about, you know, Mitch McConnell's daughter, us hanging out with her.
Yeah, you know, Mitch McConnell, now, you know, Senate boss, you know, you and his daughter were classmates at Brown School. Mm-hmm. But anyway, the decision, you fell in love with Holyoke, and the decision was made, that's where you're going. I remember an afternoon, you came back from school, having met the one of the directors at the Savannah College of Art and Design in South Carolina, or Georgia, I guess it is, Savannah, Georgia. And she knew your art teacher, and I guess your art teacher put in a word for you. And so she offered you a $10,000 scholarship if you would go to the Savannah College of Art and Design, whose soccer teams, I may add, are pitiful, and their coaches are awful, because I've refereed those folks down in Florida before.
Savannah but, College of Art and Design has a soccer team?
Oh, yeah. They got men and women's soccer team, but you know, they're not fun to be with. So anyway, we sat down and we had like, okay, here's UK, here's Cincinnati, here's SCAD, and here's Mount Holyoke. And we made this matrix chart showing all the things of importance to consider down the left-hand column. And of course, we had the four choices across the top. And we would plug in the numbers and the benefits and the liabilities where we could identify those. And, you know, University of Cincinnati was really good. And they only accepted like 30, 35 new students a year, you know, in that program. And you'd been accepted, but they weren't going to give you anything, barely any kind of scholarship money, maybe $1,000. University of Kentucky was good. You could have gone there. That would have been your least expensive choice. When we looked at SCAD and the $10,000 scholarship they were offering you and read the fine print,
it wasn't very much.
They gave you $1,000 the first year, $2,000 the second year, $3,000 the third year, and $4,000 the fourth year, something like that. But you had to stay in the most expensive dorm on campus, so that negated any of the financial benefits, so it really wasn't much of a scholarship at all.
Right.
And as it turned out, Holyoke, which was the most expensive, tuition being about $23,000 a year, turned out to be one of the best deals because, as I suspected at the time, they had a ton of money. Being an old, sister university, Ivy League University in the Northeast, and it turned out that if you kept your grades up, you could maintain that scholarship each year, and it turned out that was the best deal.
And you know that it's now $67,000 a year.
Yeah, well, it's many years later. It's it's, you know, almost 30 years later.
Yeah, I think college education's about the same, but $67,000 for your granddaughter to go there.
Yeah, so I don't know how you guys manage it, but I guess they've taken care of Shay pretty well, and she's working.
Yeah, she's doing
and so forth.
Yeah.
So the plan was to go to Holyoke, and so we started getting ready for that. And in 1990, after you graduated, and had a big numbers of family. I remember Rick Bowden came from Seattle, and mom and dad were there. we enjoyed your graduation and then prepared to get you up there, which we did at the beginning of 1990. And those 4 years were good. And each summer you did something different. The first summer you were in Philadelphia for the art program that you were director of, the inner city art program that you were art director of. You stayed in with several other students working in that program, which was a great experience. And just during the last part, I guess, of your freshman year, you met Nate at some youth, Christian youth organization. And he lived quite close to Philly, where you were working. Was it Camden?
Yeah, I was working in Camden, but he was in West Hampton.
West Hampton, okay.
Yeah.
So he came over to visit you. And from that point on, you guys sort of stayed in touch through the rest of college. Mm-hmm. Your sophomore year, you spent in North Carolina with my parents, and that was a fantastic experience for their getting to know you and you getting to know them. So that when mother died, you were able to move right in and knew where stuff was and knew their lifestyle and knew this kind of thing and helped dad get through that very difficult period in his life. Your junior year, you went to Nigeria in the spring or the second semester of your junior year, which was amazing. Stayed with our good friends Lanre and Emmy Awolokun in Lagos, and with the Ojo family in Abomasho, and traveled to parts of Nigeria I never went to when I lived there.
Which I would never travel to nowadays.
Well, Nigeria has gotten a very difficult place to be, and no, you could not go there and do that now. So it was a good opportunity at the time.
Yeah.
You came back.
Oh, and that was really important for me to go there because having gone to Mount Holyoke, with all the political correctness, you know, with all the political correct aspects of missionaries were bad. Missionaries, white people destroyed cultures, and Christians have done more damage than good. You know, that's everything I was kind of taught at Mount Holyoke. And then going there and with that question in mind, did my grandparents do more bad than good over there as Christian missionaries to destroy cultures, indigenous cultures? You know, just that experience of going over there and seeing how beloved and loved they were by everybody and just really treated like royalty, that just kind of, I was able to come away with a sense of peace that sure there were, because I think that was the same year that the Poisonwood Bible came out, which was all about, you know, these white missionaries going in and doing a lot of damage.
It was a fictional book, but it had elements of truth to it.
Yeah. So for me, that was a very good reconciliation of my history with, you know, because I was minoring in African studies. So reconciling that, just kind of reconciling those two things, indigenous traditions and Christianity, and what my ancestry, what my legacy was in that involvement. So that was good to experience that.
Yeah, and when you came back from Nigeria, I remember you're flying in, and my taking you down to visit mom and dad in Fruitland for the first time just after you returned from Nigeria. And I have a recording, and that also is on a CD, and you also have a copy of that. And of course, that's also with Duke University, of the conversation around the breakfast table. Sydney and Ruth and David and Jonathan had come down, you know, to see you.
Right.
Mom and dad, all of us were sitting around the table, and you were telling the story of when your student group in Lagos met with Tasa Loring, who was a very prominent, I guess it was sort of an editor or commentary in the Nigerian Daily Times or whatever. He was a big guy in Nigeria, even when my parents were there, in the early 70s. And you told the story about, let me back up a little bit, dad and mother, who were at the Kaugisi Baptist camp, which they started in the early 1960s and completed in 1972, But the camp then closed in 74, but when the government took over the swimming pool, they saw it as a tourist attraction they wanted rather than let the Baptists keep it. And these were some people that were supporting the government's effort to do that, to take it out of the hands of the Baptists, because they saw, you know, national Nigerian opportunity, which they cared about. And so my parents had to sort of leave the camp once the pool was shut down and go back to Igede, where they were until they retired in 1977. But before that all happened, they'd been getting some bad press in the Nigerian Times, the Times newspaper, when some people from Lagos came up and wanted to sort of bring all of their school kids up there, which was more than the parents could handle. During the end of the war, the Biafran Civil War in Nigeria, one of the military commanders wanted to let his soldiers hang out at the camp. And my dad said, well, it's not his camp, it's the Baptist camp, and it's there for a purpose. And he denied him that opportunity, which really pissed him off. And so they began giving the camp and my parents some bad press, calling it a place that's fenced off. They got large dogs there. Well, my dad did have a German Shepherd. And that it was a CIA front, which it wasn't, because my parents had made friends with one of the military attaché people in Lagos, a man and his wife, a black couple from the U.S. and their children, who actually came there when Bill Schmidt and I were there in 1972 for 5 weeks. But anyway, they were getting some bad press. And so finally, one of the missionaries, Raymond Brothers, who incidentally was at the Baptist College EWO when my parents first went out in 1945, Raymond Brothers had suggested to some of the older alumni from Lagos who had influence and power with the Nigerian government, had them come up to Igede, and Tosa Loring came with them to sort of see if Tosa Loring and my parents could make peace. And my dad tells the story of when Tosa Loring and his boys were there, that he went in and got his beaded walking stick, which was given to him by the Ewe of Ado in 1961, the symbol of a paramount chief. And he showed this to Tosa Loring, and he said to Ty, you know, your people do not give this to folks who do not love them, or to anyone who does not love them. And he asked Dad, where did you get that? And when he heard the story, he recognized who he was dealing with, and everything changed in his attitude towards my parents. Well, you came back and told about having met him with some of your student compadres. And when you introduced yourself to him, you said, I'm Aaron McGee, and my father and my grandparents are Reverend and Mrs. John S. McGee. And you told my parents his response to that, which was very complimentary of my parents and showed that and said that to you. And you told my parents that at that breakfast in Hendersonville in Fruitland that morning, and all of that's on tape, which is a nice verbal audio record of that conversation, and everybody else's voices were there. So, you know, you came back from that trip with a wonderful experience of having been there with the Awolokums and so forth. And I had not seen Awolokum since 1957 when I came back to the States to finish up high school. But my folks had kept up with him over the years. So that was the late semester of your junior year, and you decided you were going to live with Nate's family, Bob and Des, that summer of 1993. And work as a art therapist at Cooper's Children's Hospital, mm-hmm. where Des has done a lot of work over the years with kids who need surgery and stuff, international children. And so you spent the summer with, and you knew that was going to be an opportunity for you and Nate to decide, is this relationship going to end or is it going to go forward? Mm-hmm. And you spent the summer with him, and as it turned out, you guys became engaged. And then planned your wedding over the next year, and then the following year after you graduated, you guys were married. So you know, those stories are all part of your history and my history and their history, and it's amazing how things have sort of worked out in that regard. But I really value and love that story of how things were. So you were not on the trash heap.
No, I was not.
And you have always been loved by everyone who has met you and loved you. You've been a joy to me, a pride and joy over the years, and I'm so grateful for the life I have lived as a result of my parents, and the life that I have enjoyed from you, my daughter, and your family. That's a long soliloquy, wasn't it?
Well, what I wanted to say was, in terms of Grandma's passing, she, you know, God was very kind to her in the way that she passed, because I always remember the beds were all made, the towels were all set out on the beds, the menu was planned on the front of the refrigerator, she had the week's worth of food and menu on the front of the refrigerator, she had fresh flowers from her garden and the vase on the table. All that, you know, the house was neat, everything was all vacuumed. It's almost like she didn't realize that it was going to be her last moments, but she had everything prepared for a week's worth of family to be there. And of course she would have. So I just remember just getting there, because I got there a few days after, and, you know, her flowers were on the table. Her meals were in the refrigerator ready to be eaten. The beds had fresh sheets on them and fresh towels. And it was just so interesting how she was, you know, I think she went how she would have wanted to go. Does that make sense?
That makes sense. I have that little menu sheet. It's sort of like, yeah, the size of a large envelope. I have that framed on a shelf in my office, and of course that's going to go to you one of these days for your own symbolism, and I don't know if anybody will care about it after you are gone, but anyway, you're right, and you had so much to do, so many positive things to do with her memorial service there at Fruitland Institute Chapel across the street from their house.
Yeah.
I remember we had a couple of weeks to prepare for her memorial service. After she died, Deborah and I drove on back to Fort Lauderdale. And then I had a couple of weeks to prepare for the memorial service. I had some pictures, some photographs of her and Dad at different stages in their lives, which I had 8x10 copies made and put on foam board. You took fabrics of different sorts and decorated the pulpit or the there in the chapel and in different places, and it was so nicely decorated with, I think, maybe my mother's Bible, things that represented her. And it showed your artistic touch and your knowledge of her. Mm-hmm. And that was a beautiful event. So after she died, and you guys were there with my dad for a few weeks, a couple of months, then Nate received the call to the first job that he had after finishing his seminary.
Right. You have 57 seconds to go.
Okay. Anyway, let's just say this has been a good introduction, and we will
continue. And now you got to go clean my drains.
And clean your drains.